Thank you, Dan. Yes, the markets have provided much rich material to work with. That's one way of putting it. Thank you all very much for coming along today. It's good to see the room full. Let me thank you for your support of the Foundation. As a result of your generosity today and in past years, the Foundation continues to expand its activities, as you've been hearing. Let me thank the Australian Business Economist once again for your help and your very efficient logistics. Stephen and your colleagues, thank you. And also Macquarie Group, who give us a free lunch. We give the Foundation a free lunch. It's not free for you, but what that means is all the money you've paid for your ticket pretty much goes to the Foundation. So to Macquarie Group, once again, thank you very much for your support. I want to organise my remarks today under four headings, and they are negotiating turbulence, accepting adjustment, maintaining stability, and securing prosperity. So that's the four headings that I want to cover. So firstly, to negotiating turbulence. Until recently, of course, as you would all know, we were living through a period of remarkably low volatility in financial prices and financial markets and very skinny compensation for risk. There was bound to be some set of events that at least had the potential to change that, and so it's proved. Once again, some of those events have been in Europe. After some months of difficult discussions between the Greek government and its European partners reached an impasse, Greece was, as a result, unable to make a scheduled payment to the IMF. Therefore, were technically in default. The ensuing few weeks, during which the Greek authorities have had no choice but to curtail access to the banking system, have been extremely difficult for the Greek people and no doubt quite damaging for the Greek economy. There's been some progress, as you know, towards a solution in recent days, though a huge amount of work remains to be done here to put Greece and also the entire European project onto a firmer long-run footing. So far, though, these spillovers from the Greek situation have not been large. Spreads to German sovereign yields observed for the debt issued by Italy or Spain or Portugal remain quite contained. At this stage, we don't see a market response that signals serious doubts about the ability of those countries to remain in the euro. There could be little doubt, of course, about the willingness of their European partners to support those countries in the event that market conditions took a turn for the worse, as they might have done and still could had or if Grexit occurred. So the likely direct economic spillovers to the rest of Europe at this stage seem fairly small, and in a way that's not surprising because Greece is quite a small economy. Of course, things remain fluid. An unexpected turn of events, and there's been more than a few of those in this saga over the years, could change that assessment. Broader financial and economic impacts might turn out to take longer to emerge. And there are also important potential geostrategic elements to this situation, which is why countries outside of Europe have taken such a close interest. For our part here, I think all we can do is watch and wait to see what eventuates. Meanwhile, and of arguably greater relevance in our part of the world, China's economy and financial system are going through a period of adjustment and uncertainty. Recently, there have been some quite spectacular developments in the Chinese equity market. A rapid run-up in share prices that more than doubled in the space of a year, so clearly much bigger than any plausible increase in company earnings, that turned to a slump in June and July of this year. At this point, share prices remain well above their levels of a year ago, but the speculative nature of the run-up and the part played by an increase in leverage has understandably made everybody a little nervous. The Chinese authorities have acted forcefully with some very wide-ranging interventions to stabilise the situation. Now, the effect of this on the Chinese economy is hard to predict, but it may well prove to be relatively small. Share prices have stabilised, as I said. The authorities have been making financial conditions more accommodative. Households' direct exposure to equity prices overall is not that large, notwithstanding that households are an unusually large share of daily turnover in that market. And in addition, I think the rise in share prices was probably a little bit too short-lived for there to have been much in the way of positive wealth effects on spending that would then need to unwind. Other leveraged entities like banks and brokers, as far as we can see, have shown few signs of obvious stress from these developments so far. So it seems, on the basis of the information we have, that developments in the Chinese property markets and the broader financial system are probably still more important than the share market per se for the outlook. As I've said before, I think those things are a work in progress still. The Chinese economy has been showing signs of slowing in the first half of the year, but policies have been responding to that. And I think in some of the recent data, we can see at least some positive effect of those policy responses. Before I leave the international front, of course, we also have the likelihood of interest rates in the US starting to rise before the end of this year. That change, when it comes, will have been very well telegraphed. That having been said, long-term yields in the US and elsewhere are still very low, and risk premia very compressed, albeit not as much as they were. So some turbulence may well occur, and I think this is the result not so much of the first increase in US rates, but the market trying to work out when the second one will come, because that will define the slope of the funds rate over time, and that's actually the key thing here. So we may get some turbulence as markets try to price that. But sooner or later, we have to have a start to this process. And I would expect that Australian financial markets should be able to take all of this in their stride when it comes. So that's what I have to say about negotiating turbulence. On to accepting and fostering adjustment. The Australian economy, as you know, has been growing, but at a pace, according to the data, a little below what we've traditionally thought of as average, as it adjusts to some pretty large changes in circumstances. You all know the story of the various phases of the mining boom. There was a massive rise in commodity prices, which are now on their way down again, though overall, some of them still remain very high compared with longer-run history. Investment spending by the resources sector followed suit. It rose 5 or 6 percentage points of GDP, and it's now on its way back down. And finally, shipments of resources using that higher capacity have picked up, and they're still increasing. Just as an aside, unlike the situation that was posited in the US some years ago, where the idea was that the physical weight of America's GDP might be declining because of the rise of services and so on, I suspect the physical weight of our GDP has been going up quite a bit. For iron ore and coal, annual tonnages being shipped from Australian mines have gone up since 2004 by 500 million tonnes on an annual basis. So while all that's been going on, growth in domestic demand recently has been quite subdued, over the last year for which we have data up to the year to March, final domestic spending rose by a little under 1%. Well, that's quite a low number. As the fall in resources sector capital spending accelerated, as capital spending by other businesses was also weak, and public spending was roughly unchanged over that year. That weakness, as you know, has been juxtaposed with changed household behaviour. I've spoken a lot about this in the past. The big story is that after a lengthy period in which consumer spending ran ahead of income, saving fell, leverage increased. In fact, leverage measured as debt to income roughly trebled in the household sector. That finished some time ago. Now, to be sure, the rate of saving out of current incomes declined a bit in the past year or two, and that's what you'd expect with very low interest rates, rising asset values, giving wealth effects and so on. But saving remains considerably higher than it did prior to the financial crisis, and this kind of saving rate that we see today is much more likely to be the normal one than the ones we saw a decade ago. Moreover, while some households, like first home buyers, or what is perhaps increasingly the same thing today, first home investors, are taking on more leverage, many others are reducing it. They're taking advantage of lower borrowing costs to repay mortgage debt ahead of the schedule that's required in their contracts. Despite the lowest interest rates that any current borrower has ever seen, the pace of lending to households remains moderate. This isn't a credit crunch, it's not on the supply side. Institutions are very much willing to lend and competing to do so. Indeed, the Prudential Supervisor has recently seen fit, quite correctly, to issue some timely warnings about the need to maintain high lending standards. Rather, the stories on the demand side, households are being much more prudent about debt and they're holding more liquid assets. One measure of that that's quite interesting is the size of so-called offset account balances. These are deposits that you hold against your mortgage. They amount to $90 billion now. And if you adjust the housing credit data, which are recorded on a gross basis, gross of these offsets, if you adjust them for the increase in offsets, it takes over a percentage point off the rate of growth of housing credit over the past year, brings it down to just over 6% as opposed to slightly over 7% on a published basis. So these dynamics may mean, as I've said before, that the effect of easy monetary policy is lessened, at least for a time. Taking a medium-term perspective, though, the general strengthening of the balance sheets amongst formerly more indebted households has to be seen as a good thing in the future, for the future. In the interim, this somewhat more restrained attitude to debt and spending by households, combined with a similar attitude in the government sector, has meant that there hasn't been quite enough domestic spending to achieve full employment in the face of the fall in business investment that's going on. That's why we've felt that, on balance, a somewhat lower exchange rate was likely to be part of the necessary adjustment. That adjustment in the exchange rate seems to be occurring, and I would say with relatively little disruption, and it's having an expansionary effect. One example of that is that growth in services trade is picking up. The net export contribution, so-called, of the services component of the trade accounts to growth, that's about half a percentage point over the past year, as it turns out, is about the same as the contribution from the rise in iron ore exports over that period. So there is something happening here in the non-resource export accounts. It's worth noting at this point that business conditions, as measured in surveys, have tended to improve overall over the past year, outside of the mining sector at least, and that trend appears to have continued in recent months. At the same time, the state of the labour market, while still subdued, and still, I think, characterised by spare capacity, appears to be a bit better than we would have expected 3 or 6 months ago. Employment growth has picked up noticeably, and hours of work have increased. The rate of unemployment is roughly where it was a year ago, whereas we had been thinking in our forecast that it might be a bit higher than this by now, since growth in real GDP has been, according to the data, below trend. So, how do we reconcile better than expected labour market outcomes, albeit still a little on the subdued side, with apparently below trend GDP growth? Well, there are four things that I can think of that might help us explain that. One of them is maybe it's just statistical noise in the labour force data. If so, future observations or revisions may paint a different picture. Let me note in passing here that recent data on population growth suggests that we're likely to see some downward revision in the absolute growth rate of employment over the near term as those lower population benchmarks work their way through. It doesn't seem to me that that should affect ratios like the rate of unemployment or the employment to population ratio, but it probably will affect the absolute size of the employment numbers. So noise, potential for revisions, one way that we could square this slight conundrum we have. Another possibility, perhaps output growth has actually been higher than the GDP data say, in which case there would be upper revisions at some point. Thirdly, perhaps below trend growth in output and trend growth in employment can be reconciled in the form of the slower than expected growth of wages. Or fourthly, maybe trend output growth isn't 3 or 3.25 anymore the way we've been assuming for a long time. Maybe it's lower than that now. That is, maybe we've been pretty close to trend growth after all. Well, some or all of those possibilities may be at work. Time will tell which ones. I don't offer a definitive judgment on that today. Let me just make a couple of observations, though, on the way through. Firstly, I would say the economy is making the adjustments we needed to make a bit more slowly than we would prefer, but it is making them. Secondly, if the slow growth of wages has in fact been a net saver of jobs, so if the reconciliation of the labour force and output data are partly because of slower wages, well, that would appear to indicate a degree of labour market flexibility in operation. Thirdly, to the extent that the data are hinting that our assumptions about trend growth may need to be revisited, and I'm not saying that that is the right conclusion, but if it turned out that way, that's going to be worth some discussion. It need not be the case, of course, that per capita growth would be any lower if the reason for lower overall growth is simply lower population growth. So there may be no particular implications for living standards as measured by income per head. But if there were assumptions about absolute growth rates embedded in, say, business strategies or fiscal strategies or retirement income plans, then they'd need to be re-examined. I suspect this is going to turn out to be an important discussion. What is Australia's potential economic growth rate per head and why? What do we want it to be? And if the number we have isn't the one we want, what do we do about that? I'll come back to that. That's about securing prosperity, which is my fourth theme. But before that, I'd like to say a few words about the third heading, and that is maintaining stability. One of the features of much regular discussion of macroeconomic policy, and especially monetary policy, is that people tend to adopt a rather short time frame. Everyone watches high-frequency data and adjusts their expectations about what policy should do or will do accordingly. Policymakers are expected to respond to events and to deviations of economic performance from what had been anticipated. The number of surveys and obscure indicators that are regarded as conveying information about economic conditions has multiplied, as apparently has the number of commentators prepared to talk about those indicators. Well, maybe that's natural. To some extent, that's a natural outworking, perhaps, of a richer, more complex society that possesses more information. It has more analytical resources. We have the 24/7 news cycle and a competitive media searching for content. So, in some ways, you can understand why this more intense short-term focus arises. And to a point, it's perfectly reasonable, actually, to expect policy to be adjusted in response to relevant information about how things in the economy are tracking relative to what we expected and what we'd like to see. The risk in all this, though, is that this process can lead to a mindset in which policymakers end up responding to quite short-term phenomena, but using instruments that take quite some time to have their effect, including effects that might actually turn out to be adverse. And I think this is relevant to our situation. We've seen a period of somewhat disappointing, though hardly disastrous, economic growth. And we have inflation that's been well contained, and that's seen interest rates fall to very, very low levels, the lowest levels in my lifetime and in most of us here. As I've said before, the question of whether they might fall further has to remain on the table at this point. But in answering that question, it isn't good enough, really, just to say that if we get continuing evidence of softness, then necessarily interest rates should fall further without considering the longer-term risks that that may bring. Remember, monetary policy works in part by prompting risk-taking behaviour. Now, in some ways, that's good. In some respects, there's not enough risk-taking behaviour, or there hasn't been up to now. But the risk-taking behaviour most responsive to monetary policy is the financial kind. And to a point, more financial risk-taking is probably a prerequisite for the real economy risk-taking that we are really after. But beyond a certain point, that financial risk-taking can become dangerous. Now, deciding when that point has been reached is inevitably a highly judgmental thing, and that's even after the event, let alone beforehand. I would offer the judgment, and a judgment is all it can be, that policy settings that fostered a return to the sort of upward trend in leverage that we saw up to 2006 would have a high likelihood down the track of being judged to have gone too far. Now, we're not in that case at present. Given current rates of credit growth, as I said earlier, I think pace of credit growth is fine. The point here is simply that in meeting the challenge of trying to secure growth in the near term, the stability of future economic outcomes can't be dismissed as a consideration. We have to find an appropriate balance. I note here that the board's post-meeting statements routinely have been referring to seeking a stance of policy that will, and I quote, most effectively foster sustainable growth and inflation consistent with the target, unquote. The adjective sustainable is used very carefully and deliberately, and financial sustainability is very much one of the things that are in mind there. Let me then turn to my last theme, and that is securing prosperity. The transition in growth that, as Stephen said, we were talking about a year ago, and we still are, is happening. It's not perfectly smooth. But I think our economy has coped remarkably well, when you think about it, through a quite lengthy period now of very large shocks in a rather difficult world. Despite the gloom and doom and the fulminations over the airwaves and in newspapers and cyberspace and everything, business confidence has actually improved a little over recent months. One day last week, as I was preparing these remarks, in that day's edition of one of our leading newspapers, I read stories that personal insolvencies were the lowest for a decade. On the same day, I read that, according to this report, income inequality in Australia, a as measured by the most detailed survey we have, has not in fact increased, contrary to the impression so often given. Must be true, they were in the paper, right? Actually, I think they are true. These stories weren't on page one, but they were in there. So there are some good things to report, and perhaps we might conclude that we've been meeting some of our challenges thus far with outcomes that, while not as good as we'd like, are not too bad. So there are reasons to feel confidence in our future, more confidence than we often seem to. The question to be asking then is how we build on what is, I think, when all is said and done, still a pretty successful record in the past 20 years. How do we build on that and secure our prosperity in the future? And it's in this context, I think, that it's likely the questions about potential growth per head are going to become more prominent as time goes by. That's partly, as you know, because of the terms of trade story. The terms of trade going down means that income per head grows more slowly than output per head. So if we'd like to keep income per head growing, more output per head would be good. It's partly about demographics, because we know that ageing, by lowering the proportion of people in employment, will also lower output per head of population and income per head in the country. So we know all those things. We've known them for a long time at an intellectual level. But it's going to get more than intellectual is the point. I think unless we think our wants, including for publicly provided services, are going to grow more slowly, and I rather doubt that, the very practical imperative is going to increasingly be to find more sources of growth. It's increasingly clear, surely, to people as well, that step up in sustainable growth isn't going to come from the manipulation of interest rates or from year-to-year fiscal settings. Demand management policies have a very important place and a role, but they can't do everything and they have their limitations. I want to say that raising the economy's potential, which is what we're talking about here, isn't just some esoteric concern for economists, or at least it shouldn't be. Our collective ability to deliver social policy outcomes, to enjoy the benefits of a good society, or at a more basic level to provide public services or even defend ourselves, ultimately rests on a productive economy. Many problems, including distributional ones, are easier to deal with if per capita incomes are growing, much more difficult if they're stagnant. Let's be clear that when we're talking about growth here, this isn't growth at any price. Wealthy countries tend, on the whole, to have cleaner air, cleaner water, better health and education systems, more demanding standards for environmental protection or employee safety or leave entitlements. They can afford that because their business sectors are so productive. They also tend to have higher wages. Not because they decree wages to be high, which we've tried a few times in our past and it doesn't work. Wages are higher because well-educated, skilled workforces working with a lot of capital and technology are more productive. And the poorest peoples around the world typically have much less in the way of these things. So if we care about well-being in the broadest sense of these words, these things, we should care about things that affect potential output per head. I would submit that our citizens care very much about this. They don't frame the question as being about GDP per head or non-farm market sector productivity per hour worked the way we might, and they care about more than just narrow economic statistical outcomes. Many of them would be concerned to lessen our environmental footprint. They wouldn't want to sacrifice civilizing aspects of our society, many of which come from government intervention. But nor will they accept a future in which they're marginalized in the global village because of an unwillingness to adapt or to invest or because of a failure to foster a growth economy. These people are going to care about growth. There's a lot of talk right now about reform, and that's all good, and I haven't come here today to kind of pick up that drum and bang on it. Let me suggest just one thing, and that is that the case for reform, quote unquote, really needs to be presented as a positive narrative for economic growth. That's what we need. We all know that competitive markets, investment in education, skills, infrastructure, and adaptability in our businesses and our government organisations are key parts of that growth narrative. That's the Productivity Commission to-do list, actually. Those reforms matter because of the gains to incomes that result from better allocative efficiency, and that's very important. But they also, it seems to me, would support entrepreneurship and innovation. That is, risk-taking, to use another term, and the kind of risk-taking that we actually most need. Measuring entrepreneurship, of course, is far from straightforward, and various studies that I've seen briefly show different results. At the risk of oversimplifying, one might say I think that Australians hold our own in the entrepreneurship stakes as compared with other countries, but we don't score at the top, so clearly there would be room to improve, and that's a reason for confidence. We can do better here. And all of the so-called reforms, the growth narrative, should help that. And that entrepreneurship, innovation, dynamism is a major source, ultimately the main source, of our future prosperity. So that too can be part of the growth narrative, the narrative of how we build on the success enjoyed to date and secure an even more prosperous future. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. Thank you once again for coming out in support of the Anika Foundation. And I hope to see you again next year for another round of challenges. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn, for that very detailed and thought-provoking speech. Certainly very interesting topics that you've covered, and you know, again, in such detail, so we thank you very much. So now's the opportunity to ask Glenn some questions. If we can please keep the questions short, to the point, state your name and affiliation. We'll get through as many as possible. There's two microphones up the front, so you know, one on either side. If you could approach the microphone and I'll call you out and we'll get through some questions. So who would like to go first? Is that Richard? Yeah.
Hi, thanks, Governor. One area or one region you didn't mention except in passing with reference to China was Asia. And of course, Asia's a lot more than China, and the rest of the region does seem to be having some difficulties with maybe some excess leverage, a weaker global trade cycle. What are your thoughts on the extent to which what's going on in the rest of Asia is directly relevant for Australia and policy settings? Thanks.
I agree that Asia is much more than just China. I think that's a very important point. And the point you make that in a number of instances, there's been a run-up in leverage in recent years, and so all of that, working that through, is still a work in progress. And all of that's relevant to Australia. And as the global rate cycle enters a new phase with the US starting to lift off apparently by the end of the year, some of that will be tested, so that's a thing to watch. I don't really have any more to say about that today. We'll be publishing some updated forecasts in a couple of weeks. Thanks. Bill
Edmonds from Westpac. Governor, I wanted to sort of speak a little bit more about that labour market trend growth topic that you so interestingly covered. At the moment, the Reserve Bank is forecasting 3.25% growth for next year, up from 2.5% this year. And we generally accepted that the 3.25% was trend. And we also accepted that you needed to get to trend to stabilise the unemployment rate. If in your deliberations, as you implied, may be the case, you conclude the trend is in fact lower than 3.25%, would that mean it's okay to not to need to force growth back to 3.25%, or would it be that there's still a lot of spare capacity in the labour market and policy should be focused on reducing that spare capacity?
I think what the labour market data are saying on their face is that spare capacity is no longer increasing. If you literally accept that the unemployment rate hasn't moved for a while. So it hasn't increased by as much as we had anticipated, if those data are correct. There's still some spare capacity there, though, and it would be a desirable thing over time to use that spare capacity. I think that would be a reasonable objective for macroeconomic policy. How quickly you can do that, of course, we could debate, but I think over the horizon of several years, it would be okay, it would be desirable, in fact, to have above-trend growth for a little while to start to bring the unemployment rate back down. And so far as we're able, that's something that we should be interested in doing. Rory?
Governor Stevens, Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. You've used this occasion in recent years to push back against some of the public gloom. I think one of your speeches was a glass half full.
Not always with success, yeah.
A glass half full of a lucky country. And today you've highlighted some of the brighter recent news on employment and unemployment going flat at 6%. House prices still rising strongly, so there's a lot to be happy about. You've talked about, you know, the interest rates that are out there for borrowers are pretty well the lowest anyone's ever seen. And you've talked about the need for financial stability over the medium term. My summary of all that is that you seem decidedly unenthusiastic about cutting rates below the current record lows. And my question is, does that sound about right, or should monetary policy be pushing harder to get unemployment well down below 6%? Thanks very much.
Well, I think... Where do I start? I think there is some better news of late, and I think that should be said. I also would refer to remarks I've made in the past about the limits of what monetary policy over a short period can expect to achieve in the environment we're in. So I think we've got the balance I was talking about in the talk, I think we've got that right at the moment. But of course we make a new decision each month, and you'll have to wait to see what we have to say about that for a couple of weeks.
Matthew Johnson, UBS. Governor, thank you for your speech. I wanted to ask some questions, or a question about investment. It's fair to say that investment globally since the financial crisis has been very disappointing. And the IMF wrote an interesting chapter about this in the most recent World Economic Outlook. During your speech, you emphasised that you thought that the terms of trade were important in Australia as part of that story, but I would like to respectfully point out that it's been very disappointing everywhere in the world, and I wanted to know why you think it's been so disappointing, and then in ending thinking about Australia, what happens to investment in Australia if the terms of trade goes back to average, which is what everyone thought it would do before we decided we believed in the China boom.
Well, just on the terms of trade and investment here, you're quite right that capital spending at a global level has been weak for some years, and that is an issue, a conundrum that many people globally are talking about, and we're part of that, I suppose, perhaps in the non-mining part of the economy. In the mining part, I think it's pretty clear that the terms of trade event had... You know, we had an unprecedented pickup in capital spending there, which is now, as I say, on its way down. What will happen from here? Well, I hesitate to make a forecast. My view had been, and I suppose still is, that the level of capex outside of the resources sector is very, very low, and at some point that's going to have to pick up just... through the fact that capacity will be starting to run down. But that isn't going to happen as soon as I had hoped. If we believe the capital expenditure survey, I'm not sure whether we should, but if we do, non-mining investment's probably going to fall, actually, over the coming 12 months. So, as we've often found in the past, you can wait a long time for capital spending to pick up, and I think that's because businesses wait to be more confident that there's the demand to use the extra capacity that they may be thinking of putting in place. That dynamic's not new, but it's a rather drawn-out event on this occasion. Beyond that, I don't really have any words of wisdom to impart on global investment. My observation is this is part of another conundrum, which is globally we have a lot of financial risk-taking and not very much real economy risk-taking. What you think about that, why you think it's happening, they're very important questions, but I don't have the answer.
Thanks, Governor. James Stevens. James McIntyre, Macquarie Bank. With that Freudian out of the road. You've articulated in the minutes yesterday, also articulated the decline in population growth and some of the more higher frequency data that some of us here in the room are prone to focus on indicates that may have been slowing further. That does have some implications for a further slowdown in potential growth if it does persist. But I can't help thinking that lower potential growth rates would generally be associated with a lower long-run potential or neutral interest rate. In articulating that our potential might be slowing, have you just articulated the case for rates to be lower for longer?
I think we've already said that normal or neutral in the world we're in looks like it's lower than it used to, and that's likely to be the case for a while. Let me leave that at that without offering a precise calibration.
Maybe Dodgers from the Australian Governor. As you know, there's always one question from the Australian dollar. So would you say you're broadly happy with the level of the dollar now, or is a further fall, does it seem likely and necessary?
I'd say it's adjusting, as you'd expect.
Governor Michael Potter from Uniting Care. I was wanting to draw out your views on productivity. You've mentioned in your speech that labour market outcomes are better than expected, but growth is not. That implies that productivity outcomes have been worse than expected. And everybody's been commenting over the past, many years that productivity growth will improve when the mining boom, when we enter the production phase of the mining boom. Does this mean we are still waiting for productivity growth to occur, or is there something else going on? Are we actually seeing a secular decline in productivity growth?
Well, arithmetically, what you say must be true if both bits of the data are correct, in some sense. Whether that's the right interpretation or whether some of the possibilities I outlined earlier might turn out to be the case, that remains to be seen. My own view about productivity is my guess is firms are trying much harder in the past few years than they had been before that to get costs down, to get productivity up. I think all our liaison tells us that. And I think that's good. So I'm, in that sense, without being able to prove it at all from the figures, certainly, I'm a little bit more optimistic about productivity than I might have been a few years ago. But that's a hypothesis, really, and it can't be any more than that. It's just an observation based on a lot of feedback that we get. Certainly, productivity really is everything in terms of potential growth, and potential growth, as I've said, I think is the thing we've got to be trying to focus on lifting. Sir.
Philip Lasker, ABC TV, Governor. Just another media person searching for some content, I think.
You have my sympathy.
Well, they're meeting across town discussing tax, and you did mention reform in your speech. One thing that people seem to agree on is we need to find a way to fund the future cost of healthcare and education. two solutions, I suppose, that have been put forward are increasing the Medicare levy and doing something involving the GST. I'd like to know what you think would be preferable, given that both in some ways might represent some sort of fiscal contraction. On the GST side, if you provide too much compensation for the increase in the GST, you then leave less money for reducing the burden of healthcare. But on the other hand, if you hit households too hard, then that's you're hoping households will actually help us through the transition, which could take a number of years. What sort of impacts would those two solutions have on the economy?
Well, that's pretty complex, and I'm not going to buy into tax reform or fiscal policy in any material way here. I would assume that, by the way, there's two things which I think are being conflated in discussion out there at the moment. There's tax reform, which is different structure of taxation, and then there's whether we need more revenue if we can't lower spending. They're at least conceptually distinct, though they'll perhaps be addressed together. But, I mean, if they are addressed, Phil, presumably it's over a reasonably lengthy time horizon, in which case I don't know that there's going to be big impacts from a kind of cycle management point of view that we would need to worry about. I could be wrong about that, but my assumption would be that we would be talking, if these changes were to occur, about them being phased in over a reasonably lengthy period. That's the best I can do on that today.
Thank you. Craig Scatella from Global Management Group. Post the GFC, the RBA hiked benchmark interest rates from 3 to 4.75%. It attracted foreign capital, and the Australian dollar averaged through 2010 through to 2013, basically nearly parity. This decimated a lot of export earnings in Australia, including mining, education, tourism. It also led to the bankruptcy of many small, medium and large enterprise businesses during that period of time here in Australia. During that period, I wrote to you on multiple occasions mentioning the evils of the overinflated Australian dollar as a result of higher monetary policy compared to the rest of the world. This was also backed by various political and editorial and journalist commentators at the time. Given the benefit of hindsight, was that a wrong decision of the Reserve Bank during that period to have hiked interest rates at the same time global interest rates were coming down?
Well, let's look at the outcomes. Here we are, 5 years on? We're achieving the inflation rate, the unemployment rate's a little high, the economy's growing, and we've got policies set appropriately for, I think, for the conjuncture, and the currency's done what it was going to do, which is it went up when the terms of trade were at their highest level for 100 years, and it's come down as they've come down. I think, myself, the system was working. That's my view.
Governor, it's Sue Lannan from the PM program on ABC Radio. APRA, of course, this week announced new capital requirements for the big banks against their mortgage books. Do you think that that will see a significant increase in home loan interest rates? And if that happened, would that be a good thing if it dampened property prices in Melbourne and Sydney?
Well, the changes to the risk weights on housing, that is a response, as I understand it, to the Murray Inquiry, which said that should be done for competitiveness grounds. So I would imagine it will result in some rise in mortgage rates from the major banks. It's supposed to. That's the point. This was about redressing a perceived competitiveness landscape point. And that was the whole idea of it, as I understand it. Now, it's for the banks to decide, of course, what they do, but if they made that adjustment, no one should find that surprising or controversial. The whole point of it was to change the competitive landscape between the majors and the others, wasn't it? That was the idea. You can't do that unless some prices adjust.
And just to follow up, would that be a good thing if it lowered property prices in Melbourne and Sydney?
Would it what, sorry?
Would it be a good thing?
I'm not commenting on that.
Governor Carrington Clark from Sky News, you pointed out that when the US does move on interest rates, it'll be very well telegraphed. Would the RBA rather wait to see when they do move, given that it will have a likely impact on the Australian dollar and may not mean that you would in turn have to lower interest rates in Australia?
Well, I think all we can do is make our decisions month by month on the basis of the information we have, and I think the Fed's telegraphed the way they're thinking about as clearly as you can. I think that's very welcome. And so that's the information we have, and we'll make our decisions month by month. I don't really want to, speculate about whether that means we wait or not to do something that we might have thought about doing. No comment on that. Sorry to end with no comment, but there we are.